From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Science and American Education, this week on Soundings. My guests are Shirley Malcolm and James Rutherford of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. The following discussion is the third segment in a series of four programs about the future stakes of education in the United States. Major funding for this series comes from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. Shirley Malcolm directs the Opportunities in Science program at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, where her colleague James Rutherford serves as Chief Education Officer. Here is Shirley Malcolm.
Well, there are a few places that you can find across the country that actually have pretty good science education, where the students are introduced to science early, where they feel that this is something that is exciting and wonderful, where they have, where they come to have an understanding of what science really is, not a bunch of book work, but actual doing of science. But I would say that more likely than not, that isn't the case. The teachers aren't comfortable with science. They stick too much to textbooks that are absolutely portraying wrong notions about what science is. They focus in on the learning of nomenclature and a whole bunch of terminology and essentially turn kids off.
Why does this happen, Jim Rutherford? Is that the sort of problem that you worry about at the American Association for the Advancement of Science?
Well, Wayne, it's one of the problems we worry about. It's a difficult problem. There are 2.5 million teachers out there in elementary and secondary schools. Very few of them have had substantial training in science. Some of the high school teachers have, almost none of the elementary and middle school teachers. Even the high school teachers who, on paper, seem to be properly prepared, in fact, have had a deficient education in science from our viewpoint. Mm-hmm. This refers to what Shirley was talking about. They may have learned the details, the laws, the principles, some of the facts, but what they haven't got on their inside is how science really works.
So what we're talking about is teacher preparation. Help me to understand what's good and what's bad about what occurs now with respect to teacher preparation. Shirley?
Elementary teachers tend not to have enough content to understand what science really is. And the high school teachers tend not to have enough pedagogy to understand how you teach it. Mm-hmm. And somewhere those things are going to have to meet, because it has to be a marriage of what you teach and how you teach in order to really get us over where we are right now.
Jim Rutherford?
Yeah, a good example of that is the fact that when students are taking their undergraduate science courses, what do they experience? Lectures in large lecture halls with professor using up an hour just talking. No intercourse, no talking back, no learning by exploring. They go into canned laboratories where the answer is clearly already known and your task is only to see if you can come up with it. The very antithesis of the openness of science itself. So if that's their experience, how can they then go into a high school and not do anything but emulate what they themselves encountered?
Well, this is a reflection of the large dilemma of American education. We expect and we want educational excellence from our students and teachers, and yet we're devoted to educating all of the nation's children. For example, Shirley Malcolm talks about students not understanding what science is. What have you got in mind, Shirley?
You have teachers wanting to say what the answer is. And I think that there isn't some sense of what the questions are. It isn't a matter of simply telling students what discoveries other people made down through the years and bringing them up to our present knowledge. It's a matter of having the students leave the classroom with the idea that we know everything, Not that we, that there are lots of things out there that we don't know, and that people like them can in fact be engaged in finding out the answers, or that scientists don't always agree about the details of particular theories or what have you. They don't get this sense of the challenge, the continuing search for knowledge. People realize that this there is a system of problems here. And it requires a system of solutions. There is no way you're going to be able to tinker with one part of it and expect for the whole thing to come together. There's going to have to be the political pressure to reform what we currently have. You get the sense of inertia, behavioral inertia, as it were. We've always done it this way. It was good enough for my parents or my grandparents. Well, I'm saying it's not going to be good enough for my children. They're entering a different kind of world, and I, as a parent, am going to have to stand toe-to-toe with the political leaders who are trying to make these things happen in the local community. The community groups are going to have to support this, realizing that to fail to make this work is to probably deliver economic and social havoc on those communities as well as on this country. It's going to take total restructuring of schools and schooling, and a total restructuring of the way that teachers are trained and what they are expected to do in classrooms, or even if we have classrooms at all. It's going to require a rethinking, and the curriculum rethinking is an integral part of this rethinking process. It's not the only, but it is an integral part of this rethinking.
Jim Rutherford.
It's also a long process. Shirley's absolutely right. We're dealing with a system of systems. The authority is widely dispersed. The financial resources are disaggregated. So if you want to change something that has a large number of institutions, a large number of people working at it, a large number of clients, then you have to take the time to do something. But it also, we need leadership. And it has to be national leadership, and it has to be positive leadership. We haven't had this for quite a while. We need a leader at the very top, the President of the United States, that says our future is at stake. That's been the strength of America. It will be our strength. And provide the kind of national sense of purpose long enough for the states and the local school districts and all the other parts of the apparatus to reform themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's be specific and concrete, Shirley Malcolm, Jim Rutherford. What are the requirements now in 1988? What should they be? What, a couple of years down the road, by the end of the century? Again, be specific for me. Math, science, specific and particular requirements that kids are taking now and that they need to take. Shirley?
Well, I would say that a large part of the problem is that there's not general agreement about what children should be taking. The states all have different kinds of requirements. Some states, even though they have tightened up on these, many states, they're saying 2 years of mathematics or 2 years of science. Well, can a society that is based in science and technology really survive with 2 years of mathematics and 2 years of science when that's the end, essentially, of your science and mathematics experience? Then there's the question of what science and what mathematics. Mathematics is sometimes business math or consumer math. There is absolutely no sense of the need to acquire the skills that are related to algebra. Mm-hmm. There is no understanding of relationships in space, of geometry, of the probability and statistics, in spite of the fact that those things impinge on our lives daily in the newspapers, in the polls, in the on the television, that we're talking about these kinds of issues. On the science side, again, the last science that most students get is biology, and not always good biology, not enough biology to understand, for example, the reproductive choices that they may have to make, or the choices that they may have to make as parents or as citizens who are worried about toxic waste disposal or the preservation of their environment or these other kinds of issues. They have very little sense of the physical world. They tend not to get chemistry. and heaven forbid, they will not get physics. And besides, even if we wanted them to get physics, who would teach it? I mean, there are some serious, serious problems. They don't understand the fundamental base of technology and how that actually works, or how it relates to our society, or how it builds on the physical principles. I mean, there is much. It's much easier to say what we're not getting than it is to say what we are getting.
Jim Rutherford?
Let me take a crack at saying some of what ought to be going on. Let's talk about the youngsters, the kindergarten, first few grades. What they should not be doing is learning the names of atoms and molecules and stars and the names of plants and animals. They should be out handling nature, collecting things, looking at things, describing things, pushing them around, growing fish, growing plants, beginning to ask questions. Really getting connected into nature and beginning to get this sense of that you can ask some questions, and that if you look right and push right, you can even get some answers. You should also have those young people in those grades doing lots of reading, some of which will be reading about nature and the stars and animals.
Well, these are all noble, wonderful goals. Why aren't the kids doing it? Is it a question of the money that the citizenry would have to invest toward these ends? What are the obstacles here?
Well, in this case, with these little kids, the obstacle is the perception. The teachers are under the gun to teach science. They don't know science. So what do? They retreat to a thing called an elementary science textbook that gives them answers about the world. But that helps the teacher get through this 20 minutes a day that's been assigned to them for science, where they would be better off doing none of that out of a science book and every other week or so having a day where the kids could explore. The point is that neither the teachers, nor the administrators, nor the parents understand enough to permit that kind of openness.
Well, let me propose an alternate scenario there in this ideal world of science education, Jim Rutherford and Shirley Malcolm. Why is this necessary? I mean, we live in a fragmented world, which is not to say necessarily divisive. We live in a world of many interests. Kids can take their lives in many directions. If I know how to balance my checkbook or use a calculator or listen more or less intelligently to a meteorological report, why do I have to have this sort of stuff? Why should kids have it? It isn't really necessary, is it, for them to survive into the end of the 20th century? Shirley, Malcolm?
It's absolutely essential for them to survive into the next century. If you say, I know how to balance my checkbook, and the first question I would say is, balance it with what? They're going to have to make a living, yeah. And the nature of work is changing, and it more likely than not means some kind of a connection or interconnection with technology. The jobs that are out there in the economy, we can't all serve hamburgers to each other. At some point,
may have been Jesse Jackson.
At some point we have to have an economy that is also based on making things and on inventing things. Who is going to make those things? Who is going to invent those things? Lester Thoreau talks about the fact that we can't find the workforce, just the regular, ordinary, day-to-day people who would go into the plants and understand the design requirements for certain kinds of components that were being made, and that Japanese and Korean plants, they can find this out of high school people, and that in our plants we are having to get graduate level trained people in order to have the same kinds of understandings. It's fine that we know how to work a calculator, and that's laudable. But the question is, do you know when to add, subtract, multiply, and divide?
I see.
And those are the kinds of different levels of skills that are not coming through in this current system.
Jim Rutherford, Shirley Malcolm, we're talking about science and education in the United States. Tell me about the textbook industry in the science education establishment. Is it a healthy thing? Is it a bad thing? Jim Rutherford, what's going on there? Again, the teaching of science, how our youngsters absorb all of this.
Well, the textbook industry is a industry that has to serve a large enterprise out there. That enterprise is grouped in funny ways so that, for example, in some places, whole states will make a determination to use a certain text or not to use a certain text. So the publishers have learned that in order to survive and make a profit, they have to tailor their book to each of these constituencies out there. And so the books become larger and larger and larger. There are biology texts that run 600, 700, 800 pages. Goodness. Physics books are running 6. You say, wait a minute, these are ordinary people like the rest of us, and in a year we're going to cram all of that stuff in? The words proliferate. A modern biology textbook will have more new words in it than a foreign language textbook for a year. So here we're dealing with complex subjects, which we're after understandings, we're piling on fact after fact, because the publishers can't seem to find a way to get out from this, what they regard as a financial problem of serving all these diverse customers. How will that be broken? I don't know. My guess is the entrance of a new technology, that electronics and visual mechanisms and other ways of teaching may gradually depress the significance of the text as the centerpiece of modern education. But my guess is that the industry itself won't do it. It's not in the nature of industries to change very much. Just remember that the train people didn't become the plane people. And they're both in the transportation business.
Right.
And it's a tough problem. The other thing I'd say about text, and this is just a conceptual thing that a lot of people would not agree with me on, is I think it's wrong-headed from the outset. You see, they're not like regular books. It's a teaching technology. Every few pages, it interrupts and asks questions. There are glossaries at the end of the chapter. There are problems for you to do. Things are in color. Things are bold-faced. Now, as adults, we simply go to books. We have to learn to find our own way through them and learn how to ask the questions and look up words we don't know. That's what an educated adult should be like. We, in the rest of our lives, don't use textbooks. So I think building a dependency on children to this kind of a document source, which they then will not use again, is just bad education at the outset. I'd like to identify another problem or two that hasn't come up, Wayne, and see if Shirley agrees. One of them has to do with testing.
Hmm.
We're becoming more and more, as a nation, focusing in on examinations as a way of deciding what sort of progress is to be made.
Not only of the students, but of the teachers.
Yeah.
Figuring out who can teach.
Indeed. But think of the consequences if you're asking the wrong kinds of questions. Suppose you're asking questions of science that the payoff is that you've memorized some facts.
Right.
You'll get a good score, and that will be known, and you'll learn more facts, and other people will try to emulate you. And so you have, in fact, the wrong test can undermine the very thing you're trying to get at. So one thing we need is some other ways of examining young people.
We look at this in terms of pre-med education, but we don't look at it in terms of just general scientific education. The quality of the mind coming to the scientific enterprise. Shirley, Malcolm?
Well, there's the issue not just of the test, but the things that the test can't measure that we value in scientists. Imagination, creativity, the ability to solve a problem once you come up against it, the ability to see multiple explanations for things and to realize that you have to test them out and look at them one after the other, and what is the sequencing of doing that. There we say we value these things. We say that these are components that of good scientists and attributes of good scientists. And then we turn around and essentially negate them by forcing anybody out of the system who does not, in fact, who can't score well on this one measure of memory and the cognitive kinds of things. And there are all these other things that we don't even ever look at.
Jim Rutherford, would you say that the United States is, in fact, competitive in the world marketplace with respect to the scientific training of its young people?
I can give you a schizophrenic answer to that, I think. One is, and most fundamentally, I don't think they're doing a very good job either.
They, meaning the Japanese and the Germans?
Any of them. Uh-huh. It's old-fashioned, it's bookish, it's based on memorization, it doesn't reflect the true nature of science, it doesn't deal with the concepts and the shape of things.
So what, are we being hit over the head with alarmist headlines here? What?
Well, no. The other side now of being schizophrenic is that in the classical sense of science education, they're doing a vastly better job than we are.
Fundamental things, you mean?
Fundamental things. More of their young people learn more math and science than our. Every comparative test that has been made, we have run well back in the pack behind the Japanese and many of the Europeans and the Scandinavians. And it's a difference in attitude. When I visited China, for example, some years back, I was pleased to find out that in their high school, every youngster takes science and mathematics every year. They don't ask you if you think you would like or are able to learn some trigonometry. They assume you can.
Mm-hmm.
So they are simply digging in, have made the commitment in those countries. We've published a book on this at AAAS, taking a serious look at them. They have made a policy commitment that we haven't, which is that all of their youngsters in their schools, which is not quite the same as ours, are going to get educated, become educated in science and mathematics.
Well, that isn't necessarily going to happen in the United States. I mean, it becomes, if not an ideological, a sort of a political issue in the sense that you cannot mandate a nationwide scientific curriculum. Can you? Don't we have, we allow for disagreement and diversity in our schooling. Shirley, Malcolm?
Of course we allow for disagreement and diversity, and we have all those school systems that everyone sits out there and talks about how you in fact change them. But we have come to a lot of agreements and understandings and consensus without mandate. I mean, that I have no problem with the fact that if we all could agree with what everybody ought to have, that in fact we couldn't get the states, you know, this state, North Carolina did it, therefore South Carolina was to do it and Alabama was to do it. You know, that kind of competition among states wouldn't in fact move us along. But I think that we have some much more fundamental problems with regard to this whole question of will and who should get it and who shouldn't. Jim mentioned that in China there's this perception that in fact everybody will get it. I mean, there's the assumption that you will. But I think that is grounded in the assumption that you can. And it is not clear to me that in this country that we feel that everyone can. That it has, I think that too long the science and mathematics has been seen as an elite kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. You either have it or you don't genetically. It's the old nature-nurture issue rearing its ugly head again. And that there are certain people who tend not to have it. And that the genes tend to be concentrated in certain places and they tend not to be concentrated in other places. Well, the minute you make that determination, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I think that if one could say that, I mean, we women don't have it, minorities don't have it, except Asians who have a lot of it. I mean, these are the kinds of things. Poor people don't have it because these things are highly correlated with socioeconomic status. And the minute you start to make that determination, then you start to group students. Early, you group them. And then the
this
grouping,
kid is poor and therefore unable.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Then the grouping leads to tracking. And essentially what you have done is you have taken away that child's opportunity to learn.
How do you beat this, Shirley Malcolm?
If you say that every child can learn, even science and math, if you make the expectation, if the parents have the expectation, that the children have the expectation, the teachers have the expectation, that the system has the expectation that everyone will in fact get this, that there are common understandings that will be gotten. And the interesting thing is that the research indicates that when you move to that kind of cooperative, interactive, learn from each other kind of activity in the classroom, guess what? The women students, the minority students,
everybody
learn better.
Yeah. That's right. It's not a loss. You know, Queen Victoria sent over a group to investigate the United States because we did so well in science and mathematics. How could it be when we seem to be so poorly educated? The conclusion was that we weren't terribly good at the higher realms of education, but America took seriously the education of everyone, and that was our strength. Here we are, a century later, and our strength is at the very top levels, and we've moved away from this notion that our real and true strength in science and math and in everything else is our determination to see that all of us get a decent education. That's what we have to go back to, and I think that's where we're headed.
We got to flip-flop the flip-flop, in other words.
While keeping our strength in graduate education.
Shirley, Malcolm?
I guess I am concerned that science has become a chore. It has become something that has to be endured. And all of the fun has been taken out of it. I want the fun back in it. I want to learn something. I want my children to learn something. But I want them to understand that the reason that I stayed in this graduate, stayed with this education, was because I was able. I looked ahead and saw that I was going to be able to earn a living doing something that I liked doing. And that is a real, real precious thing to have and to be able to do.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the third segment in a series of four programs about the future stakes of education in the United States. My guests were Shirley Malcolm and James Rutherford of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, where Shirley Malcolm directs the Opportunities in Science program, and James Rutherford serves as Chief Education Officer. Soundings on Science and Education in the United States is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 399. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Major funding for Soundings on Science and American Education comes from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. The views expressed in the preceding discussion are the participants' own and are not necessarily those of the Carnegie Corporation of New York. Next week, the fourth and final segment of Soundings on the Future Stakes of Education in the United States. My guests will be Charles Blitzer, director of the National Humanities Center, and Lynn V. Cheney, chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Classroom Laboratories, next on Soundings. The impact of science and technology upon American education is indisputable. But does American scientific education continue to set a world standard? What do the experts foresee for scientific education in today's world of educational reform? Some answers and insights from two representatives from the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Classroom Laboratories, this week on Soundings.